My students struggled the most in the academy. Previously.
Tuning in, we're going to start in just a few moments, so please stay tuned.
Welcome to the 503rd episode of COVID Calls. This is a discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic with a diverse collection of disaster experts. My name is Scott Gabriel Knowles. I'm a historian of disasters at the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. Today, I welcome Jacob Steer Williams, Yunjong Chu, Ivo Loro, and Jacob Remus to the discussion. We're coming to you live from Seoul National University in South Korea in front of a live audience, which is a first for COVID Calls. So thank you all for being here today. Just a reminder, you can catch COVID Calls live on the COVID Calls YouTube channel or the COVID Calls Facebook page. And you can hear COVID Calls anytime recorded as podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, Podbean, or anywhere you get podcasts. Please help spread the word and send suggestions for future guests and future topics. According to the World Health Organization, as of July 26th, 6,952,522 people have died of COVID-19 globally. 35,153 have died in South Korea. 26,957 people lost their lives to COVID in Portugal. And 1,127,152 people have died of COVID in the United States. I've been reading an obituary or a story of advocacy for those impacted by the pandemic, and I'd like to continue that now. The headline is, families of those lost to COVID wrestle with mixed emotions as emergency ends. This was written by Julie Mossman and appeared in the New York Times May 11th, 2023. It's been slightly updated. Shannon Cummings, age 53, has tried to push forward after her husband, Larry, a college professor, died of COVID-19 in March of 2020. She flew from her home in Michigan to Southern California to attend a Harry Styles concert with family members and friends. Twice a week, she meets with her group therapy classes. She started going out to lunch in public again, a step that took her years. We lost over 1 million people in the pandemic, she said. It doesn't honor any of them to not live my life. Yet she's still grappling with the milestone the nation marked in May, something of an official end of the pandemic as the Biden administration allowed the 3-year-old coronavirus public health emergency and a separate declaration of a national emergency to expire. I feel like some people never really embraced that there was an emergency going on, Ms. Cummings said. It's really hurtful to those of us who have actually experienced a loss from this. The end of the coronavirus public health emergency in the United States came at a point when vaccines are effective and widely available. Testing is easily accessible and treatments have vastly improved since the beginning of the pandemic. More than 1.1 million Americans have died of COVID and the rate of death has markedly slowed in recent months. In 2020 and 21, it was the third most common cause of death. By this point in 2023, preliminary data show it has dropped to seventh. But the move by the Biden administration landed with mixed emotions for many Americans who have lost family members and friends to the pandemic. For some people, it has brought worries that the pandemic is being politicized once again. What's triggering is when people say, now we know we didn't have to shut things down or wear masks, said Corey Lusignan, a resident of Florida whose father, Roger Andreoli, died of COVID in 2020. I got an intimate, up-close look at the suffering, and it led me to believe that we didn't make hasty or inconsequential decisions. Those were choices we had to make, and there were good reasons for them. For others, it's a welcome acknowledgement from Mr. Biden that the country is in a different place from where it was before. I don't think it's premature, and I don't have any hard feelings that he's going to do this, said Vincent Tunstall, who lives in Chicago and lost his brother Marvin to the virus in November of 2020. Mr. Tunstall said that he was still being more cautious about COVID than many people wearing a mask when he's in an indoor public space or on his daily commute on the train. Any mention of COVID reminds him of his brother, a lingering pain known only to those who've lost people in the pandemic. Unfortunately, when I think about COVID and the pandemic, thoughts of him are intertwined with both of those, he said. Pamela Addison, a COVID widow, mother of two, and advocate for survivors, said the administration's decision to allow the emergency to expire was a reminder that the federal government could do more for children who have lost parents and caregivers. The kids are overlooked constantly, she said. We don't want to talk about them. It's like we don't want to talk about the fact that they exist. The end of the emergency declaration could result in new costs for coronavirus testing because private insurers will no longer be required to cover up to 8 at-home tests per month. Laura Jackson, who lost her husband Charlie to the coronavirus, questioned the necessity of the move. Leaving Americans with out-of-pocket costs related to the virus is the equivalent of dumping this back on the public, she said, while the country remains unprepared for a future pandemic. There's so much more work that needs to be done, she said, noting that there were still questions about the origin of the virus in China. We shouldn't be turning off resources, she said. For Ms. Jackson, who lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, the end of the pandemic's classification as a public health emergency nearly coincided with the anniversary of her husband's death on May 17th, 2020. Both days, she said, have filled her with dread. She still encounters people on a regular basis who deny that COVID is real or who imply that her husband died because of his pre-existing conditions, a comment that stings. I never felt like we acknowledged those who we lost, Ms. Jackson said. I feel like we've always been in a hurry to move on from it, but it's still so real. The story was, families of those lost to COVID wrestle with mixed emotions as emergency ends. It appeared in May 11th, 2023, New York Times. Before I introduce my guest today, I just want to take a moment to thank COVID Calls listeners for your continued enthusiasm for and support of this project. The archive of episodes number 1 to 502 recordings made in 2020 to 2022 are available at covidcalls.com. Thanks to the unceasing work of Eleanor Mays and a huge team of transcribers, archivists, and artists. Today's episode marks a sort of new start for COVID Calls. I will be holding calls weekly throughout the remainder of the year. As always, please send me your suggestions for future episodes. We really rely on your ideas. The pandemic may have changed. Many governments may have declared it over, but in so many crucial ways, this disaster has only just begun. The suffering continues. The fights over its longer impacts are well underway. I know that we're all exhausted by COVID, but now is not the time to act like it didn't happen. All right, let me introduce my guests. Jacob Steer Williams is a historian of epidemic disease based at the College of Charleston. He specializes in 19th and early 20th century Britain and the former British colonies. Professor Steer Williams is the author of the 2020 book, The Filth Disease, Typhoid Fever and the Practices of Epidemiology in Victorian England. He's also a frequent guest host of COVID Calls. Ivo Loro has a master's degree in environmental engineering from the Faculty of Sciences and Technology of the New University of Lisbon. He is currently a PhD student with special interest in history, the Anthropocene, and sound studies. Yunjong Ju is a professor and director of the Living with Slow Disaster Lab at Busan National University, and among her many publications, recent one is an article titled Relationships and Boundaries, Humans and Animals in the Age of Corona. And Jacob Remus is a historian of modern North America with a focus on urban disasters, working class organizations, and migration. He's the co-editor with Andy Horowitz of Critical Disaster Studies, the first collection about the emerging interdisciplinary field of critical disaster studies. Jacob Remus and Yunjong Ju, Ivo Loro, and Jacob Steer Williams, thank you for joining me today on COVID Calls.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, it's the first time for me to ever do this live, like with a group of the people that I'm interviewing in the space, in the room together. And so we'll see how that goes. There was always that distance and always the faces in the little box. It's really exciting to me to have you all gathered around the microphone. I'd like to start the way I usually have done, which is just to ask you what the pandemic situation is like where you live. And we're all gathered here right now in Seoul, but many of you have traveled from other places. So I want to kind of get an update on where you're from. And I want to start, Ivo, with you. Maybe you can give us a little update on what the situation is with COVID in Lisbon.
Yeah. Wow. When you ask that, the first thing that came to mind, COVID? What COVID? because it feels like a long time ago. It also kind of reveals how privileged I am, because COVID is gone where we're from. There's no more talk about COVID on the news. Every so often, something, but experts try to warn us that, you know, this might come back or another thing might come in. So we should be vigilant, but this is very sporadic. So most of the time we don't actually have, and we don't remember COVID anymore. What I feel like is that COVID left three things. One was non-judgmental attitude towards the use of masks, even though COVID is gone, you can still use masks on the street, in public or inside, indoors. People won't judge you, which would be something that people before would find very strange, or they wouldn't feel comfortable around you. So now that is gone. Also, the same with the use of gel, sanitizing gel. And the other thing that I think that COVID has left, and I mean, if we're talking about how's the COVID situation, since there's no COVID, I feel more it's more about what COVID has left. And the other thing is so mental health has become more privately and publicly recognized as an issue. Even to the point where now health insurances, which are private, will give you free mental health consultations to psychiatrists, and something that they never did before, psychotherapists. Mm-hmm. So psychiatrists, you could get like 3 a year, now you can get like 6 or 7 a year, and you can get some more of psychotherapy, which was something that never before was allowed. And I feel that COVID and the fact that so many people suffered mostly with the lockdowns and mental health issues, a lot of the young people, so teenagers, early 20-somethings, mental health has become very important to them. So I feel like this is also kind of a result of COVID. So informs a little bit.
Yeah,
what is the more broad COVID landscape right now in Portugal?
But I mean, to me, it's so interesting that we would have had sort of infection rates or even death counts at certain points at the ready as a way to describe. And you're describing sort of a need and a demand for mental health resources, mm-hmm. which that's big sea change, I guess, in that particular type of healthcare coverage. You're saying this is something new that comes out of COVID.
Yeah, that is on the private sector, I would say, and but on also on the college level, I see a lot of students now just putting it out there. It's a big concern to them, and people, even teachers, are more tuned to that now. So.
Jacob Remus, let me ask you the same question. I know you're still a little jet lagged probably from coming in from New York City, but give us an update in New York.
Yeah, well, I mean, the short answer is we don't know the state of COVID in New York because there's so little testing. There's basically no testing. And with the end of the emergency declaration, it's harder and harder to get testing, to get tested, even if you have respiratory symptoms. Physicians are often refusing to order COVID tests because there's no guarantee that they'll be paid for. So what's then left is some sewage monitoring and hospitalizations and deaths, which are way down. So in June, the United States was averaging 80 deaths a day from COVID, which is still 80 deaths, but also is just drastically, drastically lower than it had been before. Anecdotally, I would say the kind of masking is way down. When I'm on the subway, there's about 1 to 5 people on the car. So each car probably has 100 people. So 1 to 5% of people are masking. It was never at 100%, but it used to be up in the 80s or 90s. And now I think what we have in New York is increasing numbers of fights over sort of the legacy of the materiality of COVID. So there's so New York allowed restaurants to take over parking spaces to serve outside. And what there is increasingly now is neighbors who don't like the noise or who want their parking spaces back. And will that remain? And it's not even phrased as a COVID thing. It's who controls streets? Should we allow, on one side, they say, should we allow profit-making companies to take over our streets? On the other side, it's isn't it nice to be able to be outdoors? The other, I think, lasting, again, sort of fight that's really a major political fight in New York right now is visible homelessness, which there was a major housing crisis that kind of comes out of COVID, major disruptions to mental health and drug services. And so many more people, and particularly many more people who are visibly in distress are now on the street. And in New York, what this has led to is a mayor and a police department that use violence to solve a housing and mental health crisis. And so the legacy, so one of the things that I'm really wrestling with is in the height of COVID, I think when we first spoke in March or April, there was of 2020, there was this sense of political possibility that all of a sudden, all of these things that in the American political context had seemed impossible, letting people out of prison, canceling or at least limiting student loan debt, a cash payment for kids, free healthcare. All of these things suddenly looked possible. In some cases, they actually happened. And now there has been this incredible foreclosure of those possibilities in a variety of ways, whether from legislation or the courts or executive branches. And one of the things that I'm really trying to think about and help get other people to think about is where did that, it seems funny to remember my optimism in April 2020, sure. But I felt an incredible amount of political optimism in April and May 2020. Mm-hmm. And some of that has continued. There are places in the United, not New York, but there are other places in the United States where especially some of the housing reform and the restrictions on evictions or restrictions on rent increases, where that has remained or that's been codified. But for the most part, all of that political possibility has ended. I'm still wrestling with that.
Yeah, let me just follow up on one part of that. And I don't expect you have can't have a comprehensive view of New York City. Such a thing is impossible. But I wonder, you know, you mentioned you're seeing greater amounts of homelessness or it seems as if more people who are in mental health distress on the street. When you're talking with people, is there a causal link made to COVID? Do people even comment on that? Is it sort of understood that that's somehow an after effect that goes along with this stage of where we are with COVID? Because if so, it's one more, like we used to talk about infection rates and now we talk about how many people are sleeping in the subway station. We're talking about COVID in both cases. We're just talking with different measures.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, I think there is this sort of before and after. I don't know that we have a really firm causal link. I do think that the disruption of mental health care services was a major part of it. And the really enormous shifts in the New York City rental housing market is also a big part of it. I think that your question really points to the flexibility of the word COVID. What do we mean when we say this is COVID? Is it that when we said, well, testing is measuring COVID, yes, but it's measuring disease and infection. When we talk about increases in number of unhoused people, yes, that is also measuring COVID, but it's measuring a different thing than what was being measured by testing. And I think that one of the real difficulties in thinking about COVID as a periodization or as a set of events or as a set of processes is that flexibility with which we mean, sometimes when we mean COVID, we mean the disease. Yeah. Sometimes we mean a particular presentation of the disease that happened before there was good treatment and before there was vaccination. Sometimes we mean the shut in the United States, there was never really a lockdown or a shutdown, but the partial shutdown of ordinary life. And sometimes we mean even broader social processes. And I think that as we as scholars continue to think about COVID as a set of phenomena, we're going to have to come up with better vocabulary so that we don't mix all these things in together and we start to take these things apart and think about, if we think about COVID as a set of processes that existed before the origin of the virus, well, like the housing crisis in New York has a different set of origins than, I was going to say the housing crisis in New York has a different set of origins than like restaurant policy. All of it is like everything in the United States is based in capitalism and white supremacy. So like, it doesn't really have a different set of origins, but like it has a different set of proximate origins. Right. And so we're going to have to think about these things carefully.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. Yunjung, let me bring you in to the discussion, and your viewpoint would be from Busan and from Seoul.
Busan and Seoul.
Yeah.
Okay. During COVID, and we still do the testing. we still do the count of us. So the government and the government is government recently said that the number of the COVID infections is increasing right now, but they will not count anymore soon. They will stop. So what we have gained and what we have lost so far, I think there were many good things. There were some good things from the COVID, and there were many bad things from the COVID. I think that the first thing is that Korean people are very work-oriented people. So we really work hard. So we do not stop and we do not take vacation. But after the COVID, I think people can say, no, oh, I will take some rest. Yeah. So it's possible. I think not possible for everybody, but for somebody, some people, we can say no. And we can, it can be some kind of official excuse. And the another good thing from the COVID is that relatively, I think Korean government was at the time well prepared and took actions relatively very immediately, the vaccination and also the many preventive measures. So I'm a sociologist, so the Korea is a country which is very famous for the low trust in public affairs. We have the high trust in the families or the individuals, but usually low trust in the public affairs. But I think after the COVID, the people could somehow begin to believe in or trust in the public administration and the public affairs. So I saw one survey saying that the survey done by the National Commission of Human Rights about the human rights situation in Korea. And in that statistics, people replied that the human rights level is better during the COVID. So, but the human rights scholars were furious at the statistics because we had so many stigma and the discrimination against the LGBT and Chinese and racism. So that with my fellow human rights scholars, we were complaining all the time. The situation is not better. It's becoming worse because we have a very severe censorship or the severe control of the digital contact tracing. It's almost like a surveillance technology during the first of the emergency of the COVID. So we were complaining all the time, but the general survey said the people said human rights situation is becoming better because people felt that they were cared by the government by being given the vaccination at the proper time. And they felt that they were somehow taken care of. And so as a result of the at the party at the time, the we had kind of the we had the general election. So the Democratic Party at the time won the landslide victory. So it led to the some political result because the people had the trust, big trust in the ruling party. But somehow later they lost. But the bad thing from the COVID is that recently I'm really worried about the young people's mental health. And also the I had a discussion with the Japanese sociologist about the situation in East Asia. We are sociologists are really worried about the increasing suicide rate of the especially female youth, young women, because our guess is that maybe increase of the domestic violence because they are locked down or that they stay only in within the family. And mm-hmm. and also the another possibility is that usually the young females work in very precarious labor, not the regular jobs. So the service work, whether they were at because of the lockdown or the many jobs were closed. So the right now the among the people who are doing the mental health, they are worried about the mental health and the suicide rate of the females who are in their 20s. And also the teaching at the university, when I meet my students, especially the first year student, they have a really little experience of the collective behaviors like a school trip or the school discussion, and especially this generation belongs to the disaster generation, Seoul Ferry. Mm-hmm. So when they were in the elementary school, they couldn't go to the school trip. So the I tried to have some group discussion or the team project with the students, but the students felt really difficult because during their high school time, they only had the class individually only Zoom, so that they didn't have any teamworks. So the lack of the kind of the group works or the collaborative works, I'm really worried about that kind of individualizing process. And also that leads to the many changes in the social customs in Korea. So you know that we are Confucius society, so we used to have big ceremony of the commemorating ancestors. We have the lots of the we call jesa. We have lots of the commemorating ceremonies. They are mostly gone. So it's good for women. We don't have to prepare people. We are so happy. But it's kind of the end of the tradition. So recently, my mom said that my mom is she was born in 1943. So she said that recently her friend died, but her friend's family didn't have any funeral ceremony. So the tradition or the ritual is totally very quickly changing. So the end of the tradition, it can be good for a modern girl like me. But somehow we are losing the tradition of the connecting with the dead people or the ancestors. So good and bad work together.
Jacob Steer Williams, can you give us a postcard from Charleston, even though you're here with us? And then I want to follow up with you. I've got a follow up after that. But go ahead and give us kind of.
Yeah, thanks. And just want to say so amazing to be here in person and experience COVID calls in a very different way. You know, I think a lot of people here and on this call spend a lot of time thinking about COVID calls and reflecting on what it means and what it's done the last 3 years. And this particular episode is really important for me. So thank you all. You know, Jacob Remus talked about one story of America. And, you know, as I was sitting here listening to the commonalities and the divergences, in some ways, the U.S. South is a different country and has experienced COVID in a completely different way. And, you know, one of the things that seems to be happening in where I live in the US South in Charleston is, you know, we never domesticated mask use. There was never high upticks in any part of the pandemic on wearing masks. I shared stories, I think early in COVID calls of, you know, when we were forced to continue teaching at my university throughout the pandemic in person for most of the period. I distinctly remember one point, because I was also, we pulled our both of our children out of school and I was caring for them at home and then also teaching classes. And at one point, had both my children walking through campus with masks on and a group of, you know, university students just made fun of us in the open in front of my children, made fun of my children, made fun of me, just openly mocked us. And that experience always will stick with me my entire life. It probably will stick with them as well. You know, for this trip to Korea and in Japan, I brought my son Langston, who's been a real joy to be on this trip so far, and really looking forward to his experiencing of this workshop and thinking about disasters and memorials. And a few days before we left, 2 days before we left to get on a plane to come to South Korea, we had a friend's birthday party. It was in one of these indoor kid areas. And he asked on the car ride there if he could wear a mask. He said, "I don't want to get sick for our big trip." And I said, "Of course." And, you know, he has no problems. He's so used. He's from this disaster generation that, like, wearing a mask is no big deal. And thinking about disease prevention is something that he has completely domesticated in his own mind, in his everyday habits. But we get to this birthday party, and I overheard, and it was just one of these childhood moments. Another child just said, "Are you sick?" And that was a real eye-opening something for me that I thought about for several hours afterwards of not something unique to the U.S. South, but a sentiment that is deeply ingrained in the U.S. South, which is like the mask isn't about humanitarianness. It isn't about caring for other people. If something's wrong with you if you're wearing a mask, was this other child's experience of the mask, which is a different politicization of the mask that we've seen throughout the world, but it's appeared in different ways in different countries. So that was one interesting example that I think you can tell about the U.S. South. The other that I've been really thinking a lot about is vaccination rates. And so, you know, the U.S. South, most states never got above about 60% for vaccination rates. Where I live in South Carolina, that certainly has been true. We got to about 60% and we never got higher than that. You know, the folks that were not going to get vaccinated were never going to get vaccinated. And that's certainly continued. But what we've seen is a kind of afterlife of that, or like a downstream impact. I've been following this. And, you know, the studies from this particular last 9 months have been that what we're seeing in rural areas of the U.S. South is other childhood, regular scheduled immunizations. Parents aren't bringing their kids in for those now either. So there's been like this afterlife of vaccination debates that the consequences of it are, you know, to me, part of the pandemic. Even if the emergency declaration in the U.S. is over, this is still part of the pandemic and the impact of it. We're still seeing, and it's still part of this debate. You know, the other thing that I keep thinking about the U.S. South, and, you know, this is like syndemic thinking, and it builds off what Jacob was saying earlier about political mobilization, which is that, you know, we saw in the U.S. South in particular during the pandemic, these really vocal cries and grassroots organizing against government interference, that COVID policies in the U.S. to some constituents meant government overreach over vaccinations or lockdowns or any number of other, you know, scientifically viable public health decisions to mitigate the spread of the disease. And then all of a sudden in 2023, what we're seeing in the U.S. South is a lot of those same politicians are pushing for over policing of women's reproductive bodies and of educational policies. And so I think, like, something, again, I think of those as part of the pandemic as well. And they're ones that I think are not, they're rendered invisible. So, you know, a couple updates from Charleston. The only place that I'm really seeing mentions of COVID are my COVID refuges. And those are, and part of a couple teams with the medical university of South Carolina, which is our big medical school, teaching hospital and teaching university in South Carolina. So I'm part of a COVID Memorial Oral History Project where we're still collecting, and I'm still trying to find stories to add to our archive. And then also is a epidemiology intelligence project, which is trying to track long COVID. And so I'm working with some epidemiologists to try to continue conversations about long COVID. And, you know, one of our recent studies that came out was that 26% of South Carolinians who have had COVID have self-reported to this team experiences of symptoms of long COVID, which is a shockingly high number, actually, to me.
Just want to take a moment to remind you all that you're listening to COVID Calls. This is episode number 503 of COVID Calls, and the first time we've been on in a while. And I'm talking today to Ivo Loro and Yunjong Ju, Jacob Steer-Williams, and Jacob Remus. Jacob Steer-Williams, I want to come back to you on this and then bring others in. So in the obituary article I read, just to come back to the context of that article, April 10th, 2023, President Joe Biden declared COVID as an emergency was over in America, the United States. May 11th, Korea did the same. May 17th, Portugal did the same. Within a very short window, governments around the world, in line with World Health Organization and other, you know, health data organizations around the world, sort of collectively decided this is over now. I'm just asking it this way. How important is it that the state says it's over? And I ask this because you and I have had so many conversations about pandemic, endemic, endemicity, certain kinds of very important public health concepts. But based on what we've just been talking about, there's real ways that it matters that executives say it's over. And then in many other ways, to me, that just seems not only misplaced, but it just opens up a whole set of questions about why they need to make a declaration like that.
There's never one over. There's never over. There's never an end. Certainly when we're dealing with complex human, animal, ecological, evolutionary beings that we are in our relationship with infectious disease. You know, one of the things that I keep thinking about with all of these declarations of ending emergency measures is, I think, for the politicians who make them, they're expedient decisions. They're inherently practical political decisions that are, you know, they're about funding issues, and they're about, you know, by what emergency declaration, what sort of things for insurance companies and testing. And I think, you know, politicians are in these heated meetings daily about this, and the cost numbers, I think, at some level get put in conversation with daily deaths and hospitalizations at some point. And I think we saw this really ramping up in the early months of 2023, as more and more people stopped talking about COVID and COVID became, and, you know, I've been doing some really funky, weird global newspaper searches on COVID for the last year, and doing some Python scripts with a computer scientist who's helping me to, like, just look at big data for COVID and how it's being mentioned, when it's being mentioned. And I really got into this because, you know, COVID started to be called an endemic disease. And this is something that I've been writing on and thinking a lot about. And what does that really mean? And it turns out it's a whole big Pandora's box of research questions. But one of the things that has been really clear is that mentions of COVID start to decline, and then the political machinations of ending COVID happen, right? And so, like, what's the relationship then between, this is, I think, at the heart of your question, between the political calculation of just a nation state saying COVID's over, or a big international group like the WHO, which is March 5th, which starts all of the domino effect.
Yeah.
So it's WHO et al. Of making that declaration over. That's, I think, a very expedient act. But really what had preceded that, if you follow the cultural dots, is actually a whole bunch of us as a global society stopped caring about COVID. And then our governments declared it to be over, probably out of, like, mostly economic rationale. And I think, like, that is a more important question than just, like, what happens when a government declares a COVID emergency to be over. Is actually what I think happened is we collectively, culturally decided it was over. And then our governments just followed suit.
You know, I mean, I think about that just in terms of discussion you're having about mask wearing. You know, I mean, the kind of date that we should be looking for probably is not when President Biden says the pandemic is over. It's when there's a sort of cultural tipping point and people in different places say it's over for us. Mm-hmm. We're going to, and I think in some parts of the United States, it never started. And maybe in other places, maybe not in the US, but other countries up until recently, it went later than the date that the state set, you know? And I think those timelines are important to keep in mind, not to diminish the resources that dry up when the state says it's over, but there's other timelines here, I think, that, that really matter. Jacob Remus, let me come back to you. Anything that anybody said that you want to react to, but I'm particularly interested in this, the way we think about the end of a disaster and that that's the time to sort of like take stock. So according to the way we traditionally have thought about disasters, well, the state says it's over. The relief checks are now pretty well done. And so now we should, historians are supposed to walk into the room. Let's include sociologists, please. And anthropologists and artists are supposed to come in, make sense of it and make a memorial. Is that, do you buy that? Is that happening? Is that the stage where we are now?
Well, I think I have two answers to that. One is, this is a very US answer, is that COVID was so politicized. COVID, like everything else, is always already political, but it was politicized in a particularly pernicious way, so that any discussion of COVID, quote unquote, being over or the end of the emergency is wrapped up in these Trump era questions of, did COVID ever really exist? Was it a big deal? Are you, are you denying COVID if you say that it's over now, or if you say that the emergency is over? And then of course, it's also wrapped up in these questions that what the emergency declaration did was A, release a series of resources for good or kind of welfare state resources. So it's ended that. So one of the things that the end of the declaration did in New York City was there had been these tents around everywhere, in, at least in Manhattan, where you could get effectively free PCR tests. And it wasn't immediate, but a month or so after the end of official COVID emergency, they're all gone. And now you can't get tested anymore. So that's a real loss of resources. The other thing that it did, which I celebrate, is it ended the invocation of Title 42, which was the so-called, which was Trump's public health excuse for a really draconian exclusion of all migrants. Not of all migrants, but of migrants that the government didn't want. Now, when Biden ended the use of Title 42, he just brought in other policies that also were to intended to exclude migrants. But the extraordinary government power kind of worked in both directions. That did not at all answer your question, which is about memorialization. I mean, I think it's really early to know what any of this means, right? I think about...
Wait, it's over though.
Whoever it was, well, so is the French Revolution, but it's too early to know how that turned out too, right? I mean, I think we don't have, like, for historians, sociologists, I think, are used to making, to understanding things really quickly. Historians traditionally have needed more time. So I mean, again, this is why I'm thinking about, well, what's the difference between now and then? Why did it look like there were all these political possibilities 3 years ago, and now there were, like, those are the, and again, I don't think we have the answer. I don't think as a historian, I have an answer to those questions yet. I do think what we're beginning to understand, what we're beginning to have the time to do now is to formulate the questions. And those are going to keep changing. As the experiences of COVID, the disease, keep changing, as the experiences of COVID, the political event continue to change, our questions are going to keep changing. one of the things, I think every time that we have spoken on COVID calls, this is now the third one I've been on, I think, I have said this, so I'm going to say it again, which is that tuberculosis is a disease that kills 3,000 to 4,000 people a day, every day. It went up, in fact, during the height of COVID because so much care was disrupted. And it's a disease that has been medically curable since 1947. Nobody talks about that as a crisis. Nobody talks about that as a disaster. There have been no declarations by anybody that ended anytime recently or that began anytime recently. And it's because it's a disease of globally poor people. In the United States, it's a disease of people who are in prison. And nobody cares.
Is there a global tuberculosis memorial?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't even know what that would look like.
Yeah.
No, I mean, what there is a global NTB, NTB goal. And I think that the kind of the memorial that those few people who care about tuberculosis want is eradication.
Yeah.
But unlike COVID, it's not seen as a disaster and therefore doesn't get any of the resources. And so what we're seeing now is COVID becoming like tuberculosis, right? It's becoming this thing that is, we don't have a cure, but we have really good therapeutics. We have really good both pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical interventions. And it will increasingly become a disease of the poor.
Ivo, you've been very patient and there's a lot on the table here. So I just want to bring you back in. Is there anything you want to comment on what we're talking about? But I'm also really interested in your sense of this issue of time and when is the right time to engage memory and memorial acts. And you are a person who thinks very deeply also about kind of the aesthetic possibilities of memory, not just building a architectural thing and saying, okay, now we're ready to remember COVID. I think you're quite attentive to other ways that memory could be working. What do you think about this issue?
Well, first of all, I would like to talk about, you said dates, official dates to the end of the pandemic in Portugal. You said May 17, 2023.
That's when the government declared. Yeah,
I didn't get that memo.
you didn't receive a letter from the president telling
you? For us, it was probably May 17, 2022, like you were saying.
That's what others are saying, yeah.
Exactly, like you were saying. And what happened is that COVID, as I said already, it went away because suddenly it gets substituted by Russian-Ukrainian war. That is the main thing on TV, on media right now. Every day you get that's the major. And the other thing that concerns more the Portuguese, which is the result of the Russian-Ukrainian war and still backlash of COVID, is inflation. So that was also a big thing throughout the first part of the year. It's getting better now, but it's cases are coming one after the other. So after that, you get a political scandal, political corruption, impunity, arrogance from the government, a housing crisis that is getting worse and worse, which actually COVID kind of was, it was a stone in the shoe. So it eased a little bit the housing crisis because suddenly evictions were forbidden. New Airbnbs were also forbidden. So things changed a little bit at the time. Now it's getting back because we still have gentrification, tourism. Tourism came back now, this year. Maybe the tourists got the memo because 2022 was good. This year is insane. Right now there's...
Yeah.
I think this week, next week, there will be more 2 million people in Lisbon, which is the actual population of Lisbon, because the Pope is there. So we have the Pope. And there's the drought and climate change. So there's a bunch of things happening. And this led to kind of COVID just being like diluted into to the news, which also I think leads a little bit to kind of forgetfulness. And I don't see anything about memorialization of COVID. Maybe the disaster generation will kind of feel that a bit more deeply when they come into their own 30s or something, and they start to like realize how their lives were probably very different from the other generations. But right now, I don't see anything like that. I don't see anything like that in the news. Doesn't seem to be a concern at all, because there's this whole other bunch of problems that people are dealing with.
Yeah, what you're describing to me harkens back to some things that were said early in the pandemic, which were kind of taboo, and they made a lot of headlines. You had various people saying, oh, well, this, in the end, this might be good for the economy, or we should think of this primarily as through an economic, you know, kind of framework. And I just saw a story yesterday, which, you know, to your amazing statistics about tourism in Lisbon, and the story basically said, they didn't use the word memorial, but they said, big picture for COVID, good for the economy. And, you know, that made headlines. When somebody said something like that in 2020, that made headlines. Like, the car came to a screeching halt at that point, and people said, you cannot say that. We cannot think in that way. And I don't see the pushback against that kind of logic at this point. And, you know, as you say, the travel statistics tell a tale. And I don't mean to say individual people are saying, I want to forget COVID, so I'm going to go to Lisbon and forget COVID, but the bigger picture is they wouldn't be going there if they didn't feel comfortable in so many ways that the state has made it comfortable for them to go there and have that experience and not worry about getting sick or dying.
Yeah, that was big part of it. And it's now the major motor of the economy. There is no production of anything that gives you any value in terms of international, foreign exchange, what you have is tourism. That is the that is the big product that you have to sell. But this leads me to kind of a very lateral thing to all of this discussion, which is to say, well, it's the kind of big picture is it's good for the economy. In a global capitalist where growth is the motor of any economy, any crisis is good to the economy, because then you can rebuild, you can start over. COVID was very good to a bunch of people. There was growth for a bunch of corporations. So I think in that respect, as long as you kind of measure well-being in that kind of, in that sort of,
right,
of prism,
right,
you always see good. You won't see the bad. So I think one thing that we could discuss is like what could be, for instance, I'm very fond of this kind of perspective. Degrowth perspective for post-pandemic world. Mm. I don't know what it is, but I think that could be an interesting discussion to go into. Mm.
Yeah, we see disaster capitalism. We've seen it throughout this pandemic.
Sure,
I mean, on my flight here to Seoul, you know, I was on American Airlines, and they make an announcement like halfway through the flight or when you're about to arrive, and they say a special offer just for, you know, passengers on this flight, and it's like the American Airlines credit card. And the person who was reading this out just said, like, now that the pandemic is over, I know you all want to travel, so here is your opportunity for the special offer to get free miles to travel. And it was like totally capitalizing on a memory of the pandemic.
Just a quick reminder, you're listening to COVID Calls, and I'm Scott Knowles, and we're actually on time. This has really, the time has flown by. But I want to give, I'm going to bring back to Yunjong kind of for the last word, and then I might give you all kind of a lightning round on this. But, you know, we've been thinking about disaster justice a lot. And I wonder, you know, what that could look like coming out of COVID when so many people have long COVID symptoms. There's so many manifestations of COVID that we've been discussing in many ways. Do people have some rights here?
About the COVID justice, in South Korea, we have a legal case for the victims of the vaccination. So that there is a family union of the victims of the vaccination who say that their family members passed away due to the vaccination. And I just checked that one legal case was, the first case was won at the court. So the human rights lawyers are helping some family members for that, but I'm not quite sure about the scientific causality. It will be very difficult to prove that the causality of the vaccination to the real actual death. I'm not sure. But about the justice, I think that recently, I think that transformative justice and restorative justice, those two concepts are quite important. Because when we think about the justice, especially in Korea, we only think about the judicial system, the compensation or some court cases. But I think that not only just that kind of the individual compensation, but also that the society should gain some wisdom or some new norms to be made. I think, for example, for the restorative justice, there were many people who worked a lot at the front lines, the frontline workers, precarious labor, female workers usually. So I think that the society should remember, and also be grateful for what they contributed to the safety of the overall society. And also the another thing of the transformative justice is that we have to remember what we have doing, what we have done, the cruel things to other people during the, because I have been researching about the leprosy contagious disease, because some diseases are just a scientific disease, but the disease like leprosy is very much entangled with the stigmatization. So when I first encountered COVID, I remembered my research oral history of the leprosy victims, because we had almost the same attitude towards the COVID victims in South Korea, like to the leprosy victims. So the stigmatization and also the isolation from the society that went to the LGBT in Korea, and also that kind of attitude were shown to the Chinese people and also the foreign workers, the people who are at the boundary. So I think that by remembering what society did to so-called protect their own society, but could be very exclusionary and discriminatory, very racist, that kind of attitude. By remembering that, and so by remembering how society was awful, how awful the society was awful to the strangers, I think that maybe next time we can be different. So I think we have to be prepared not only by the scientific or medical measures, but also by the social measures, how inclusive we can be at the time of the emergency. That's very important, I think.
Well, I think with that, we're going to wrap up. And it shows me we're going to need a second call to continue the conversation. Obviously, we can't settle this, but I really want to thank my guests, Yunjong Ju and Ivo Loro and Jacob Remus and Jacob Steer Williams for coming back to the microphone or coming to the microphone for the first time to continue this discussion. And I just want to remind everybody that you can catch COVID calls intermittently, but on a new schedule on Facebook and also on the COVID Calls YouTube channel. And of course, you can see
and read all the transcripts and watch all of the episodes of COVID Calls at covid-calls.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining me. And thank you to the audience for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Stay healthy, everybody. We'll see you next time on COVID Calls.